Which album sold the most? Any idea?
I believe Trouble in Paradise remains the bestseller.
And pick your favorite.
I don't think I can. I love... Each of them has a very special place in my heart, and each of them for very different reasons. There are things I love about all of them. Probably the one I'm most proud of would be Political Not Polite, because there's more of me in that album than on any other album in terms of creativity, creative input, hard work, expanding my talent. But I love What's Wanted because it actually does, I think, capture at least some of the essence of our live performance. I Thought You'd Be Taller for the innocence of it all, for the naivete, as it were. And certainly Trouble in Paradise is a remarkable album, both in the way it sounds and in the subject matter for that time in history.
I understand you performed in Tom Wilson Weinberg's 10% Review.
I did. Once upon a time.
Tell me about that.
It was a thrill.
Where was this?
It was in San Francisco at the Valencia Rose. Man, I barely remember this. They extended the run of the show, and one of the people who was in it decided not to stay on with it. So I auditioned and jumped in and filled the spot. And it was fun and different and unique and scary. But it was great. It was a great experience.
Was Tom around much, or did you already know him, or?
Oh, I knew Tom. I've known Tom for many, many years. He was one of the first people we met who was also a singer-songwriter in opening A. That was very early in our career. I believe we even met him on our first tour. I'm pretty sure, certain. And we may have actually even spoken with him before then, because we had spoken with several other gay artists, well, several, two at least, Charlie Murphy and Tom Wilson Weinberg were, I think, kind of the only two names out there at that point.
Pretty much.
And we had spoken to both of them because we were trying to book that first tour. And from there, we have always had a very delightful, mutually respectful relationship with Tom.
I met him in 1979. I was in a gay organization in Norfolk, Virginia, and we brought him down for a conference, and he and John stayed at my condo.
Oh, really?
So he was probably the first gay act I saw.
Uh-huh. We go back that far almost. I guess we go back to, probably 81, 82, somewhere in there, 80, 81, 82. We used to stay with him in his apartment here in Boston when he lived in Boston for a while, and we've always tried to connect with him from time to time, and phone buddies and all of that kind of thing.
We touched on several of the musical heroes of our genre, like Alex Dockin, Michael Callan, Holly Near, Tom. Were there other artists that in your career you were particularly close to?
Well, Joe Braca was one who I was very close to. Close enough that we slept in the same bed together, but... boy, been close to probably as many comics as anything else. And, I wouldn't say that I'm close to Holly Near, but when we see each other, we're buds, we're friends. We can hang out. The same could be said for Alex, Lynn Lavner.
I interviewed Lynn about a month ago.
Oh, really?
A very nice interview. Of course, she's a professional talker.
Yeah, right. Well,
here's the microphone. I'll be back later. Okay. Can you tell me about the Leather and Lace tours?
Yeah. Well, there was actually only one Leather and Lace tour, per se. There were lots of Leather and Lace performances, but only one actual tour. And I remember exactly how it started. Ron had worked at a law firm as a legal secretary before we started performing together, and his boss there was a gay man who went to a club, actually it was the club that we were already performing at, the Valencia Rose, and he went to see this show and came back to Ron or called Ron up the next day and said, Ron, you've got to go down and see the show that I saw at the Valencia Rose. There's a lesbian there and she's doing your act. And we went and saw her the next night and immediately we hit it off. And this, of course, was Lynn Lavner. And long story short, Ron was able to book a tour for us. I think it was 11 gigs throughout the West Coast and South and Southwest Arizona and New Mexico. And the four of us, Lynn and her lover artists, and Ron and I, did this road tour, all four of us in a car, up and down the West Coast. And we had the best time. It was so much fun. And then from there, we just, with quite a bit of regularity over the next, 5, 6, 7 years, something like that. A lot of times when we would do concerts, producers in various towns would say, well, I want to have an opening act, or I want to do something that's both for the men and the women, or whatever. And we would often share the bill with Lynn.
Oh, she's perfect for that.
Yeah, it's a great fit. It's a really great match of styles and temperament and politics and humor. And we performed countless shows with her throughout the country. And they were all very well received.
I know my listeners would be interested in your personal relationship. First, you were lovers, then you weren't, on again, off again. Can you kind of take us through that?
Oh, God. Could you take me through it? I don't really know that I can take anybody through it, because I don't even know if I'm through it yet. What I can say is that Ron and I, to this day, are soulmates. We get each other like very few people in this world get me, and I get him like very few people get him. I think he feels the same way. We were together for the better part of 7 years as real live-in boyfriends, you know, mates, partners, lovers, whatever. During that time, there were moments where we weren't getting along very well in bed or as a partnership, as an intimate partnership. But for the most part, the first 7 years was pretty much together. We had our little rifts here and there. Then we had the official breakup, which then began several years of on again, off again, on again, off again kind of thing.
That emotional roller coaster.
Yeah, and oh gosh. And then we actually had another brief period where we didn't so much as act on it as talked about getting back together on that level. And now we're just the best of friends.
How did the shifts in your relationship over the years influence your creative life?
I think it only enhanced it every time. It was a challenge to go on stage with your ex-boyfriend standing next to you sometimes. I don't know. I know that we got some support for our relationship from our audience members. I mean, probably one of the most difficult times was after we had broken up and we continued to tour. For the first few months, we didn't tell anybody when we were on stage that we weren't lovers. And we pretty much went on with the act as it was. And then we started talking about it on stage.
And you were role models.
Yeah, inadvertently so. Was never our intention. We just wanted to be good people on stage and entertain the people. But role models is rarely something I think that you ask to be. But when we first started telling people, I mean, there was this audible communal sigh from the audience every time we would start talking about it. And it was scary because it felt like it was a real downer and we didn't want that to happen, but we really wanted the audience to, because they had been privy to it all along, we thought it was only fair for them to be privy to it when it had dissolved, you know. There are times when I felt like we got a lot of support for our relationship on stage, but there are a lot of times when, certainly in the gay community, and certainly in that period of time, there was not a lot of support for relationships in general. I mean, I'll be honest with you, there were plenty of people from our audiences who had no issues with going to bed with either one of us, if that were to happen. So, and it did. So, you know, on the one hand, you could say the audience really supported our relationship, but on the other hand, there were plenty of individual audience members who didn't necessarily support the relationship.
And where are you now? You're in Boston, right?
Yes, I'm in Boston, Massachusetts.
How did you get there?
Actually, I'm in Somerville, Massachusetts, which is two cities away from Boston. But how did I get here? I flew.
I don't mean that. Why did you choose Boston?
I didn't choose it. It chose me. I kind of went off the deep end a little bit when I was in Santa Fe and kind of got myself into some financial trouble, I guess, a jam, whatever. I ran out of money. I kind of didn't have anything left. And two friends from here in Cambridge basically bailed me out of my situation, helped me out by giving me money to get out of there and to start my life over a little bit. And one of the conditions was that I had to move here, and they would give me money. So I did, because I needed to change, needed to shake my life up a little bit.
Okay, well, I'm not hearing that part.
Why?
Well, I think it's too personal.
Okay. I'm not ashamed of it.
Well, I didn't infer that.
No, I'm just not sure it's of that much interest to anybody else, but no, that's what happened. I think it was probably, on some subconscious level, somewhat of a reaction to the change in my own life, you know, the fact that suddenly I didn't have a career and I was kind of bored and working restaurant jobs and working at a casino and all that kind of stuff, you know, just, I don't know.
What's your job now?
I'm still bored. No, I work at Trader Joe's. Do you have Trader Joe's? No, not in Texas. We aren't there yet. Trader Joe's is a unique grocery store, and I'm in management here in Boston.
Are you in a relationship?
No. What, are you crazy? No, I've had my relationship. The reality is, when Ron and I broke up after 7 years being together, it's not like we walked away from each other. We stayed right next to each other the whole time. Even just in the 7 years that we were together as a couple, I used to joke about this, but it's true. I did the math. Ron and I were in each other's presence more hours, more time, more minutes in each other's presence than my parents were in 30-some years of marriage. You can't be with somebody that long and not go through some changes. That many hours, that much time spent in each other's presence. Ron, to date, has been my one hugely significant relationship. And I can't imagine having any other relationship affect my life in that way. It doesn't mean that I'm not open to love or to having a new relationship. Of course I am. But is it something I'm searching for? No. Is it something I want? Sometimes. But is it something I need to make me fully happy? No, because I still have my friendship with Ron. He's my family. Always will be.
Let's talk about a handful of songs.
Mm-hmm.
Prince Charming Tango.
Completely autobiographical. It was one of the most delightful songs to perform. I loved performing that song. Always did. Never got tired of it. Probably because we really, like, hammed it up on that song a lot, you know? It's pretty gosh darn close to the ultimate autobiographical song about our relationship. And yet not. I personally thought it was the first real love song, one of the first real love songs I'd ever heard about real love and what it's all about. And, you know, strip off all of the romantic notions and ideals, and that's pretty much a much more realistic way of looking at love.
Please tell me about What Kind of Self-Respecting Faggot Am I?
Boy, that's a fun song to talk about. It's funny how that happened, because that song was originally, I think it was originally going to be titled I'm a Healthy, Well-Adjusted, a happy and Healthy, Well-Adjusted Homosexual, or Happy, Well-Adjusted, Healthy Homosexual, or something like that. There's something rather alliterative about the title originally. And it was basically going to be about stereotypes. The only problem is, Ron didn't even know half of the stuff that, as a gay man, he was supposed to know. Or at least as a typical, quote-unquote, gay man as a living, breathing stereotype of a gay man. He didn't even know all the things that gay men were supposedly stereotyped to know. So step in Paul, the big queen, who pretty much is the epitome of the stereotype fag. And he, we kind of worked on that together. I just kept having to give him more and more ideas, I think, at the beginning of gay education.
Tell me about the song, To Myself.
Well, for many years, that was the first and only song I had ever written by myself. And it was called To Myself. Surprisingly enough, it was actually written about the first man who, in my quote-unquote adult life, he was the first man that broke my heart. It wasn't nearly as dramatic as it sounds in the song. but it was pretty harsh to have someone say to you, hey kid, I never loved you, I never will, so maybe we better just stop this now. It was pretty harsh for a 22-year-old or 21-year-old to hear. It's not a particularly important song in the world, but in my little life it certainly is important because it was my first.
Can you tell me a little about the song Homophobia?
There's a song that went through many changes and rewrites, and we wrote new material for it all the time. That one, and also Don't Use Your Penis for a Brain, is the same way. When you're writing topical songs, the topics change quite frequently. So in order to keep current, you have to rewrite them. And it's fun to do that, actually. It got to a point with Homophobia where we were just kind of, I think, over the song, like, okay, enough is enough. We've written six new verses for that song and performed them for a year or two each, and now we're done. And I think the same thing happened with Don't Use Your Penis for a Brain. I think we were kind of hoping to retire that once we recorded it live, because we'd written about enough presidents at that point.
Tell me about the sodomy song.
It's my mother's least favorite song.
And?
So that's pretty much all I have to say. No, I love that song. Now, mind you, my mother is, or was, the wife of a Baptist minister, and she's still very much a minister's wife, even without my dad around. She plays that part quite well, and that's why I said it's her least favorite song, because she continues to think that, she's very proud of what I've accomplished with my music and with Ron. But somewhere in her subconscious mind, there is that thing that says, well, the ones with the really harsh lyrics are the ones that Ron wrote, because my son wouldn't write that way. And it always cracks me up whenever she sort of talks about things like that, which is rare. She doesn't really want to talk about things like that too much. But being me, I tend to push it the envelope with her, even though she's in her mid-70s. I still continue to push the envelope a little each time I'm with her, and I love her to death, and she loves me to death. But to the songs, you know, that one and Don't Use Your Penis, she wishes those songs weren't on the album so she could listen to the albums straight through without having to constantly remember to stop.
I read somewhere that the song was banned on Pacifica Radio.
The Sodomy song?
Yeah. Do you know anything about that?
Actually, I thought it was Don't Use Your Penis for a Brain that was banned on the radio.
Well, I read it was the Sodomy song, but maybe they were wrong.
Several of our songs, I know, were. I mean, and so it may be that the Sodomy song was as well. One of them was actually in one of the hearings that they had. It was brought up at an FCC licensing hearing, I think, in Washington, as an example of the kind of stuff that they couldn't play before 10 p.m. Yeah. Kind of crazy stuff.
Well, we played it about 9 last week.
Well, again, times have changed. Let's face it. Because you can say ass on TV anytime, day or night, and you can use the word bitch anytime, day or night now. And that wasn't the case 10 years ago or more.
Are there any particular songs that I haven't asked about that you'd like to talk about?
Well, certainly a
whole bunch of ones that aren't even recorded, which doesn't make sense to talk about them, but...
Just giving you the opportunity.
Yeah, no, I'm...
But why didn't he ask about such and such?
Certainly, I think No False Hope is one of my favorite songs. I love the arrangement. I love the lyric. I love the sentiment. I love the message of it. Some of our other songs that don't get played much, if at all, certainly on the radio, that I've always loved a great deal. Number one was, I always thought Him was an incredible indictment of the Catholic Church and would have been so useful for more people to hear it. Because I think music changes people's lives in ways that words can't.
So and we've played that song on Queer Voices in the last 3 weeks, too.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Queer Voices loves R&B.
Well, that's great. It's great to hear.
What songs that you've recorded are you the most proud?
You know, I just can't even say one song.
Okay, say three.
I don't even think I can say three. I mean, I'm proud of so many of the songs we wrote. Let me think on this for a second. You know, you're asking me to go through
99 songs. I know.
A catalog of 100 titles here,
yeah.
And remember them all. So it's a little rough. Mm. Most proud. Well, certainly No False Hope is one. I think Living with AIDS is another one. And that's because I think Living with AIDS was a song that was born out of a difficult time that didn't trivialize the time and didn't trivialize my own personal experience and wasn't written for the wrong reasons. People were asking us when AIDS first became the hot topic, why haven't you written a song about AIDS? And frankly, to write it just because it's the hot topic didn't make sense, never has, never would to Ron and I. Again, you know, you can't force a song. I love Lost Emotions. I'm so proud of that song, and I love the sentiment of it, and I love the harmonies. I think it's one of the most beautiful, eloquent, and simple songs out there. I would love it even if it wasn't something that I had created or helped create.
Which of your songs have been the most popular doing them live? You know, like, which songs of performance seem to be the most popular over the years?
Oh, Don't Use Your Penis, probably one of the most popular. And why not? Because the audience gets to sing along with you and you get to sing the word penis. You know, what could be more fun than singing out loud about penises in a gay crowd? Come on.
Which has been your most controversial song?
Well, the Sodomy song was certainly controversial when we first brought that one out. The Woman Next Door was an interesting one. Back when we first started performing that song, that was sort of before a lot of gay men had really done much of their own homework in dealing with their own misogyny and general sexism. And it was so telling that on a regular basis when we would sing The Woman Next Door, that would be when a small handful of people in the audience, all men, would get up and go to the bathroom and leave. And they'd come right back in before the next song.
That's pretty telling.
Yeah, it is. It's very telling. And, you know, Ron and I always just kind of noticed that and, you know, it's like, well, you know, they'll hear it when they're ready. You know? I think it was kind of that, you know, oh, well, this song is for the girls, so I don't need to listen to it, you know? And quite the opposite was true, actually. If There Is a God, He's a Queen was probably the most controversial song in terms of negative response from homophobic people. I would say that was probably the last straw. And another one that wasn't particularly popular among some members of our audience, we didn't perform it live very much, but when Heterosexism Strikes, again, some people thought that was too... That whole album, Be Political, Not Polite, got criticized for being too political.
And not polite enough.
Isn't that hysterical? It cracks me up. A few reviewers said things like that they've lost their sense of humor, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And I was like, what?
Did you hear some of the funny stuff on this album?
Tom Wilson Weinberg suggested this next question to me.
Mm-hmm.
What's your outstanding performance memory?
Whoa, there's been a lot of them. There was a concert in L.A. that was on one of the college campuses, one of the UC college campuses. I'm not sure which one. I think it might have been, gosh, I can't remember which one it was. Anyway, the school, or the group that was promoting the event, had used the school's mailing list and inadvertently mailed announcements about the concert to quite a few Christian media, TV, radio, print media, and it began a major upheaval, complete with picketers out in front of the concert. We actually got news coverage before the concert because of the controversy, because they were saying that these Christian broadcasting stations were saying things like that it was a state-run, state-funded university, and they shouldn't be promoting this kind of behavior at state-funded colleges and stuff.
Yeah, can't have a separation of church and state. No.
Exactly. So, anyway, it ended up being, it was a concert that we did with Kate Clinton. And, of course, the great part about that was that the concert was sold out, standing room only. They packed the place. The community came out in full force. And I just remember the energy that night being extremely high. It was like, you know, it was just great. I just remember that, that the energy was incredible. Certainly the March on Washington was an experience that can't be duplicated.
Which one?
Both of them, but for very different reasons. The first one, I barely remember the performance part. I mean, our performance, because I was so freaked out, because I had no idea who to play to. there was a sea of people that just stretched forever. And I just ended up playing to the people in the wheelchair who was right up next to the stage. But I just couldn't really experience it. And then we were fortunate enough that Holly Near invited us on stage with a bunch of other artists, and we all sang together with her. And at that point, then I got to experience the whole full thing. But at this, I shouldn't say, that was at the second one, meaning at 87, because the 87 was actually the second one.
Yes, I know.
Okay. A lot of people don't know that. That's why I just want to make sure. But then at the 93 March, it was pretty amazing just to stand up there. You know, it wouldn't have even mattered what we did. And actually, if we had it to do over again, I'd do a very different performance, but we did what we did. That was probably one of our more controversial performances, actually, because it got all the way onto Rush Limbaugh's show, which tickled me no end.
Why did it do that?
We did our parody of the Army recruiting song. You know, we had one song we could do, and of all of our songs, we chose that because that was when the gays in the military thing was really hot topic, you know. And I had my little combat boots and tutu on and everything, bib overalls and a tutu and stuff. And Rush Limbaugh had his television show, and he showed a clip of us doing that song. And it's so funny because he prefaced it by saying, "This could well be the next commercial for the U.S. Army." And then he played us, and the audience was laughing. And you could tell that they were laughing with us, and like it wasn't having the effect on his live audience that he wanted it to. They were genuinely laughing because they got the humor of it. I mean, let's face it, these people have seen, what's his name? That used to do drag in the early days of television. Tell me, help me.
Milton Berle?
Milton Berle. I kept thinking Berle Ives. I knew that was right. You know, but these people were raised on Milton Berle, so it's not like a flamboyant person, a guy in a dress kind of thing is going to necessarily freak them out or anything like that. But they were laughing, and he was like, no, don't laugh, people. This is true. This could really, you know. And it's like, they got it. They got the joke. And so it kind of backfired on him, frankly. You can hear it. I mean, you can see it on the tape when you listen to it. It's funny. I want to, if I may, go back and give another memorable moment.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't actually happen during a performance. It happened before a performance. And this is memorable only in that it was so unexpected. And it panders a little bit to my whole Starstruck thing that I still can get into sometimes. Like the first time I met Holly Near, and then the first time I performed on stage with her. And it was certainly a dream come true to be on equal footing with the absolutely phenomenal Holly Near. But when we were in San Francisco, after we had left San Francisco, we got invited back to perform at a fundraiser that was held at the Castro Theater. And among the many people involved were Peter Coyote, who was emceeing, and he's the actor, and Robin Williams was performing. And out in front of the theater, greeting people as they entered the theater, was the Ethel Merman Tabernacle Choir. And it was like all these Ethel Merman drag queens, lookalikes or whatever, you know, singing a la Ethel Merman, singing various tunes. And it was very funny. And they came backstage, and the backstage was actually the back parking lot. That was where we were all getting ready. And everybody was sort of fawning over Robin Williams and surrounding him and stuff. And, you know, they wanted his autographs and they wanted to trade jokes with him and what have you. And he actually had gone out and sung with the Ethel Merman Tabernacle Choir for a second. And he was hanging out with them for a while. And finally, when it was all over, everything sort of quieted down and he was ready to go inside the building. I walked up to him and I just said, "Robin, I just wanted to introduce myself and to let you know how much I've enjoyed your work." And I said, "My name is Paul Phillips, and this is my partner, Ron Romanowski." And the minute I started to say Romanowski, he said, "Of course, Romanowski and Phillips. I love your work." And apparently he had friends who had... He said, "I think I even have one of your tapes," or something like that. And I just, you know, it was just one of those moments where it helped me be a better person, because it was this megastar who was incredible. I thought that was one of the most generous things I'd ever heard from somebody who was that big of a star. It just seemed so generous of him to say that.
What a memory. What a precious memory that is.
Yeah, yeah. Well, good. I'm glad it makes sense and that you can see why I would appreciate that. It wasn't like, "Oh my God, he knows who I am. Cool, cool, cool. You know, maybe I'll be famous." It wasn't anything like that. It was just kind of like, wow, what a generous thing to say. And I have always felt that one of the things I loved most about our performance was going out afterwards and talking to people afterwards. And we always made ourselves very available, sometimes at the expense of getting a good night's sleep. Because we would stay out with our audience for another hour after the show, you know, and just stand around and talk to people. Because people have a need to express their gratitude in a more real way. And I don't know, it's one of the biggest blessings of being a performer for me. It always was, to be able to meet other people and hear their stories, hear about their lives. I mean, after you've been on stage performing and doing a very honest performance, you know, a very revealing performance, people tend to come up to you and be very revealing to you afterwards.
They want to share back.
Exactly. I have another memory of a man who came up to me. He was a quiet senior gentleman who came up to me after a concert where I had worn one of my outrageous sort of tenderfuck outfits like I do in the second half sometimes, you know, or like I did, I should say. And he came up to me and he put his hand on my shoulder and sort of pulled me down to him and he whispered in my ear, "I have on women's underwear underneath my clothes." Now, this is not exactly what I was used to hearing all the time after concerts, but I gotta tell you, that touched me in a way, you know, again.
You connected with him.
Oddly enough, and not even in a way that necessarily, I mean, I don't have any particular leanings towards cross-dressing as anything other than theater or fun, you know. This is obviously somebody whose connection to female clothing was significantly different and stronger than mine was. But I think what it was is that he sensed in me not necessarily even a kindred spirit, but a welcoming spirit. And I was very moved by that, because it was obvious to me that this was somebody who doesn't reveal that to very many people. And he was just, it was like he was so delighted that he could share that with somebody. And as unusual as that sounds to many people, I was just touched by it. I just thought, wow, to be trusted with that kind of information and that kind of, you know, sharing and opening up, it's just truly amazing.
For what do you think the act R&P will be remembered?
I don't know if we will be remembered. Oh, gosh. For what do I think we'll be remembered? I think we'll be remembered most for helping a lot of individual people come out, be more at ease with their sexual orientation. I think that's first and foremost what we'll be remembered for. Now, in saying that, I think ultimately, if you draw those lines to their eventual conclusions, I think what we should be remembered for is doing our little part in the grand scheme of things to help bring about change. Change happens one step at a time, one little baby step at a time, and I think we definitely move it forward at least one little baby step.
In one of your album liner notes, a writer came up with a very good phrase that you two provided the soundtrack to our lives.
That makes me very happy to think that that might be true. I think each person will remember us for a different reason. I mean, we've gotten letters from people that would indicate that our music touched their lives in many, many different ways.
Several artists have told me that you two made it feel safe for getting out there and being an out musicians.
Who said that?
Suede, for one. Jamie Anderson.
That's really sweet to hear. I think it's ridiculously egomaniacal to say things like, well, Ellen wouldn't have come out if it weren't for somebody like us doing what we did, you know. Who knows if Ellen ever even heard of us.
But it's all steps.
Exactly. We were just a grain of sand among many. But I feel like we definitely played our part. And I think that the world is a better place because of us, because of what we did.
How do you feel about getting the Out Music Heritage Award?
I am so delighted. I am so delighted to get this award. And it comes at just the right time in my life. Having not performed with Ron for a couple of years now, and feeling somewhat isolated from that whole part of my life. Ron and I talk usually several times a week, and we occasionally talk about the fact that it's a scary thing to think that when the final chapter is written, we might be written out of it. Because the reality is we didn't make as big a splash as, say, K.D. Lang or Melissa Etheridge or Elton John or any number of other people have, you know. We didn't play stadium concerts, and we weren't splashed across the national media all the time. And anything that's not splashed across the media often doesn't get written about in history books anymore. And we use that kind of as a gauge in this culture, unfortunately. And so to get this very honorable mention in what will someday be the written history is a very cool thing. It means that people haven't forgotten about us. You know, there are times when we both kind of have wondered off and on if anybody really even remembers us very much, even though we know in our hearts that there are plenty of people who still remember us and think of us fondly and probably still play our music. It's just very nice to have that. I'm very moved. I'm very honored and very proud and very thankful.